months now, and I mean, I've had a great time, and everything that I'm going to talk about today is essentially things I've been working on here, and it's very much in progress. So I'll just mention, I'll be presenting a few of the results that we have. So this is based on joint work with Rob. This is in preparation. There's also a paper with Tobias Fritz and Chris Hoynen. This is on joint measurability. This was also done here. And a third paper, which is with Sibashish Ghosh, who's my advisor. So all these three things are sort of intertwined, because it's like one third one leads on to the second one, which leads on to the first one. So before I start, I should mention a few references. So in case I'm not able to do a good job of trying to explain everything properly, you should definitely look up these papers. So first is this paper on Specker's parable. This is what appears in the title, Revisiting Specker's Parable. So this is a nice foundations paper where a lot of different things in quantum foundations, like Bell non-locality, contextuality, and complementarity, they're sort of woven together in one narrative. And well, I quite enjoyed reading it. You might like it too. The second paper is Ernst Specker's 1960 work, which was on the logic of quantum theory. In translation, it's called The Logic of Non-Simultaneously Decidable Propositions. You can find an English version here in the German. Okay, I think I forgot to include a reference to the German version, but anyway. So this paper was essentially taking a parable from this paper and essentially using that as a narrative thread for modern results in quantum foundations. And of course, these two talks by Rob, you can find them on the PIRSA archive. I think one of these is on the status of determinism in non-contextual models of quantum theory, and the other one is on Specker's parable. So these are all the things you can refer to in case you don't understand anything I'm going to talk about today. So this is a broad outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'll start with sort of a description of the framework within which all these results are phrased. So this is the framework of operational theories and ontological models. Then I'll define what it means to say that your ontological model is non-contextual in a precise sense. After that, I'll proceed to a specific scenario in which we'll study the sort of contextual correlations you can get for measurement outcomes. I'll generalize, so this we call Specker's scenario because it's kind of inspired by Specker's example. And then we generalize this scenario to all odd n cycle scenarios. I'll define what this means when I get to it. Essentially, a Specker scenario is the case when n is equal to 3, and odd n cycles is essentially n 5, 7, and so on. And then if time permits, I'll mention a small result on joint measurability, which I think is interesting, and which may have some applications to contextuality at some point. I mean, I haven't figured out any yet, but yeah. And then I'll just conclude with some things you can take away from this talk. Okay, so the motivation of essentially everything I've been doing so far is essentially just this, that to try to pin down what the classical, non-classical divide means operationally. So when you say that quantum theory sort of is inconsistent with any classical conception of the world, what does that classical conception of the world entail? So we are dealing with a particular notion of classicality here, which we'll call non-contextuality. And it's with reference to this particular notion of classicality that all the results here are phrased. Okay, so let me begin with what the I like to put things in a question form just so the structure is clear. So I'll just start with this question, which is, what is an operational theory? What is its ontological model? And how do the two fit together? So I'll give you definitions of these things. Then what does it mean for an ontological model of an of? So essentially, let me just give you a vague, sort of a qualitative description of what these terms mean. So an operational theory is essentially about things you do in the lab, a description for preparations, measurements, transformations, and it gives you predictions for the operational statistics you actually observe in a real experiment. An ontological model is essentially how you explain what you see in the lab. It's an attempt at trying to explain the statistics that you see in your experiment in terms of some well-defined statistical models underlying those statistics. And the two fit together. Essentially, the thing is that your ontological model has to be consistent with the predictions of the operational theory. So they have to fit together in that sense, that the explanation you give me for your experiments should reproduce all the results of the operational theory. So qualitatively, this is what essentially the first thing is about. Then the second thing is about what does it mean for an ontological model of an operational theory to be non-contextual. So Rob likes to put it essentially as the ontological identity of operational indiscernibles, which essentially says that if you're trying to explain something, if you're trying to explain two phenomena, and they're operationally the same, if they lead you to the same physical predictions, same operational predictions, then you should not. Then in your explanations for those phenomena, you should not introduce any differences. So if things are operationally similar, then they should be ontologically similar. So it's sort of a. If you read it in the contrapositive, it just says that ontological differences must imply operational differences. That if there's a difference in your explanation of something, I should see that difference in the operational statistics as well. Then the third thing is, so this is essentially the main question. The one result that I'm going to talk about is essentially about this. Does the operational statistics of an experiment admit a non-contextual model? So how do you decide whether the statistics that you see in the lab do admit a classical explanation in the sense of having a non-contextual model? And to do this, we devise non-contextuality inequalities, which are supposed to sort of characterize, supposed to be constraints on the operational statistics based on the assumption that your ontological model is non-contextual. Okay, so now I'll try and be more precise about these. So an operational theory is specified by essentially a triple, which is the set of preparations, the set of measurements, and the set of distributions that you can get over measurement outcomes given measurements and preparations. So P denotes the preparation procedures in the lab, M denotes the measurement procedures. So M is the measurement you're performing, KM is the outcome set for that measurement. So KM is the set of outcomes for measurement M. So this pair is essentially a measurement procedure. A measurement procedure consists of the measurement and its outcome set. And P is a problem is a probability function between preparations and on preparations and measurements. So it's the probability P of K given P and M that measurement outcome K, that outcome K occurs when your preparation is P and the measurement you performed is M. So this is essentially what an operational theory is. There's nothing. Essentially, this is what it is. I mean, there's nothing more to it, actually. So this is what I mean by an operational theory precisely. It consists of preparations and measurements. And by the way, I'll be talking about essentially prepare and measure experiments. So I do not really need transformations here. So I'll be restricting myself to non-contextuality for preparations and measurements. An ontological model is essentially another triplet where lambda is the, so this ontological model is supposed to be an explanation of this operational theory of what you see in your lab. So lambda is the space of ontic states. So by ontic state, we essentially mean the real physical state of the system. It's in the sense of so if you think in terms of statistical mechanics, for example, the your states are distributions over a phase space. So points in that phase space are like ontic states, and distributions are essentially interpreted as sort of effective things you use in your operational theory to calculate things. So there's a space of ontic states, distributions over these ontic states, which constitute the preparation procedures. So with every p, I'll associate a mu, which is a distribution over some variables, lambda. So very often, in the literature on Bell inequalities, you typically call this a hidden variable model. But there you're talking about a specific sort of hidden variable model where you're imposing locality, essentially. And so far we haven't imposed anything on the model. We're just being explicit about it. So you have probability densities defined over the space of ontic states. And these correspond to preparation procedures. And you have response functions, which are functions of the ontic state and the measurement that you perform. So they essentially give the probability that you get outcome k, given that the measurement performed was m, and the real physical state of the system was lambda. So here you're given a precise information about what the state is rather than a distribution over a set of states in the ontological model. That measurement outcome k is observed when this particular procedure is implemented, and the ontic state of the system is lambda. And the way these two things fit together essentially is by this requirement that your ontological model should be empirically adequate, which is that your operational statistics, these are the predictions of the operational theory, they should follow from the ontological model, which is that you average the probability of obtaining outcome k given measurement m over the ontic state space with respect to this distribution which is associated with your preparation. And that should give you the operational probabilities. And this should be true for all preparations and measurements in your operational theory. So this is how an operational theory and its ontological model sort of fit together. If this is not satisfied, then you don't have a good ontological model. So now that I've described what an operational theory and its ontological model is, let's just go to a property of ontological models, which is non-contextuality. So non-contextuality is essentially an assumption on what kinds of ontological models are you going to consider. So the reason we are considering non-contextual ontological models is essentially, you could say it's a philosophical reason, which is that as a methodological principle, if two experimental procedures are operationally indistinguishable, if there's no experiment, if nothing in the world tells them apart, then they must also be ontologically indistinguishable, which means that they must really be the same thing. If you cannot really tell any operational differences, then you should not assume that there's like some difference in the ontology, because if you assume differences in the ontology, those differences don't really show up at the operational level. So this is an assumption, obviously. So I think I mentioned this phrase, the ontological identity of operational indiscernibles. This notion was first proposed in 2005 in a paper by Rob Speckens. And in this paper, essentially the motivation and the first few results in this kind of framework were obtained. Any questions so far? Because I'm not sure I'm really getting everything across. If there are questions, please ask. Questions? No? OK. OK, so the experimental procedures we are interested in are essentially preparations and measurements. An ontological model of an operational theory is non-contextual if it satisfies two properties. So it has to satisfy that ontological identity of operational indiscernibles with respect to both preparation and measurement. So if you can't tell two preparations apart, then the distributions you associate with those preparations should be identical. And if you can't tell two measurements apart, if the statistics for those measurements are the same for all possible preparations that you can do in your lab, then the response functions for those measurements in the ontological model should also be identical. That's the assumption. Let's work with this assumption and see how far it goes. Right. And okay. So preparation non-contextuality. I just stated this essentially is expressed as the following inference from the operational theory to its ontological model. So if in your operational theory your statistics for preparation P given measurement M is the same as the statistics for preparation P prime given measurement M, and this is true for all measurements in the operational theory, then P is equivalent to P prime. This is the operational equivalence between the two preparations, which is that you cannot, there's no experiment that can tell them apart, essentially. That's the content of this first statement. And this is the assumption, which is that this operational indiscernible, so P and P prime are operationally indiscernible, you can't tell them apart. So therefore, you assume that they're also ontologically identical, which is that the distributions you associate with both of them are identical. And yeah, okay. So this is just notation, which I'll be using later on.
Question or comment. So this is operationally indiscernible with respect to probabilities.
Yes, with respect to the probability.
Other kinds of ways you might discern two experiments. Mm-hmm. You might look and see how they're made out of.
Yes. Right, so that's sort of a context, right? I mean, depending on how you prepare different, I mean, you can prepare the same state in two different manners, two different ways. And that's in some sense a context, like how did you prepare it? Give me the full list of details of how you went about preparing a particular state. So that's a preparation procedure. So you can have two different preparation procedures for the same preparation. You can produce the same state using two different procedures.
And
in a particular sense, which is this?
The probabilistic sense.
Yeah, in the sense, because the predictions of the theory are probabilities. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of quantum theory essentially here, but in an operational sense, I mean that the predictions of the operational theory are essentially these probabilities. And with respect to these, if they are indiscernible, then I should, it seems like a good principle to assume that they should also be ontologically indistinguishable. So similarly for measurements, non-contextuality is essentially phrased as this inference, which is that if two measurements give you the same statistics for all possible preparations in your theory, then they're operationally indiscernible because they sort of, you can't tell them apart based on the statistics. And so which should mean that the response functions that you associate with those measurements are really the same at each point in the ontic state space, which is like you have identical response functions for the two measurements. So this is, of course, an assumption. And we want to see how far this assumption goes. And so measurements at M and M prime, which, OK, yeah. So this is what I mean by operational equivalence of M and M prime. A third thing that we'll be talking about a bit is this assumption of determinism. Here, more precisely, it's the determinism of measurement outcomes, so outcome determinism. It's the assumption that the ontological response functions, how your measurement responds to the ontic states, for every measurement procedure in the operational theory are deterministic. So this is the additional assumption that these response functions are 0, 1 valued. Like you cannot have probabilities between 0 and 1. So this is a determinism assumption, and this is essentially what we want to get rid of in with respect to non-contextuality. Because in the sense in which non-contextuality is traditionally sort of considered, This assumption is implicit in all those treatments. And we want to see how far we can go without this assumption. And so I'll get to more details as we proceed. Right. So the Cushion-Specker theorem is essentially it's about the possibility of having non-contextual models in the sense that I defined, along with outcome determinism. And so in the language of this formalism, essentially in Hilbert spaces of dimension 3 or higher, a measurement non-contextual in the sense I just defined, and outcome deterministic. So these two assumptions are, we'll together call them the assumptions of KS non-contextuality. So such a model of quantum theory is impossible. So an example of that is essentially so this is the simplest known proof. So for illustration, I use this, which is that if you have a set of 5 measurements, M1, M2, M3, M4, and M5, and these are binary measurements, each measurement has 2 possible outcomes. So call them 0 and 1. And I require that the guys that are adjacent here should be anti-correlated. So in a measurement of M1 and M2 together, this guy should be different from this guy. So it should be 0, 1, 0, 1. But here I can either put 0 or 1, which means that I can only have, so I'm interested in anti-correlations essentially. I want a 0, 1 sort of valuation for each pair of measurements that are jointly measured. And the thing is that the maximum number of anti-correlations you can have, you can try and do a value assignment and see that you cannot have more than 4 out of 5 anti-correlations. So there's 5 different joint measurements here. And if you're just trying to assign values to these guys, then the bound on this quantity, which is that in the joint measurement of MI and MJ, the outcomes are anti-correlated. And you perform one of these 5 measurements at random, uniformly at random. So 1/5 is the probability of performing any one of these. And this is the probability of obtaining anti-correlation in a particular, in one of those experiments, and you're averaging over that thing. So is it clear why this is 4/5? Any questions about that? Okay. So if that is clear, then let's just break down that thing that we did, which was assigning values here. So if you break down that thing in terms of what I've already defined, there are 2 assumptions implicit in doing that sort of value assignment and obtaining this bound, which is the first assumption is the assumption of measurement non-contextuality, which is that the probability of xi given mi and the ontic state is independent of the joint measurement context. So it's independent of which j I measured I together with. So I could have measured m1 with m2 or with m5, but the way I assign values is like I'm assigning it non-contextually. So here I'm just talking about probabilities. If I'm trying to assign probabilities, then this should be true. But further, if I assume that those probabilities are 0, 1 valued, then I've essentially made this value assignment kind of assumption. So the first task, this was essentially done in that 2005 paper by Rob Speckens, where these 2 assumptions were made explicit in the usual notion. And so this is just, so in quantum theory, you can calculate, you can find a set of 5 observables which satisfy those compatibility restrictions. And you can find that the average anti-correlation can exceed that bound that we had, which was 0.8. Question? P is the preparation on which it's a state-dependent proof. So there's a particular configuration of measurements and states you need to achieve this anti-correlation. And it refers to that. I haven't like really included the details because it's not really the main point of the paper, main point of my presentation. I essentially just want to illustrate what a Cushion-Specker theorem essentially means in the simplest setting. So you do see a violation of that inequality, and which essentially tells you that a non-contextual model in the sense of Cushion and Specker is not possible for quantum theory because it does not reproduce predictions of quantum theory. So, right. So now, I mean, if you drop the assumption of determinism there in those value assignments that we were doing. So if you only assume non-contextuality in the sense that I defined earlier, and you consider this particular distribution, which is for each pair of measurements, you get either a 0-1 or a 1-0, both with probability half. So for each pair, you have this kind of distribution, ontic distribution. So that means that it's always anticorrelated, firstly. Like, so for every pair, you have anticorrelations. And in fact, you can achieve perfect anticorrelation. So if you have this condition for all ontic states, then this would achieve perfect anticorrelation in your operational theory. Because essentially, you will integrate this out with respect to distribution over the ontic space. But since this is a constant, you'll only get a half. So it's essentially it'll still be half. And the thing is, you can check the marginals here. You can average them out, and you'll see that all the marginals are random. So it's the probability of xi being 0 given mi is half. And so all the marginals are consistent. And that's essentially the constraint that comes from the assumption of measurement non-contextuality. So here, this is just by way of illustration that the assumption of non-contextuality alone does not sufficiently constrain the anticorrelation in this particular setting, because so what we'll be trying to do is we'll be trying to write operational inequalities which assume this thing, plus some operational equivalences in the sense of preparations and measurement, preparations being equivalent, measurements being equivalent. And subject to those conditions, we'll derive sort of more rigorous inequalities which sort of capture this kind of a property where, like, you know, if you see perfect anticorrelation, you should not really be so surprised, because there is a non-contextual model for it. And if you say something non-classical is going on, you do not have enough sort of justification to sort of say that something non-classical is going on, because we've just given you a distribution which achieves perfect anticorrelation. So, I mean, what would it take to essentially claim that something non-classical is going on is what we've been after. And in our attempt to do that, we've been trying to come up with non-contextuality inequalities. So let me just give a little background on this. So if the operational theory of interest is quantum theory, if you're assuming that everything in your lab is sort of described by quantum theory, if you're assuming the truth of quantum theory, then you can show that preparation non-contextuality implies outcome determinism for sharp measurements in quantum theory. So to go from preparation non-contextuality to outcome determinism, you need to use the assumption that, like, you're working, your operational theory under consideration is quantum theory. So this implication is not independent of the truth of quantum theory. Then, so essentially, the thing is that if you're looking at ontological models of quantum theory, then because of this implication, you see that the usual Cauchy-Specker notion is essentially captured in this more generalized sense. Because if your theory is quantum theory, then you can justify outcome determinism, which was the assumption we made earlier, from preparation non-contextuality. And the thing is that if you're assuming non-contextuality for measurements, then you should also assume it for preparations, because it's a methodological principle. And the thing is that this thing, that preparation non-contextuality implies outcome determinism for sharp measurements, has not been established without assuming quantum theory. So the problem is twofold. First, you need to define an operational notion of sharpness. And secondly, you need to show that this implication holds for any operational theory, if you're really going to state things in a theory-independent fashion, so to speak. So we circumvent this problem by the time-honored method of ignoring it. So we ask instead, what can we do? Like, you know, I mean, let's say you don't have this implication, what can you still do in a general operational context without assuming quantum theory? So is it possible to prove operational non-contextuality inequalities using only the assumptions of preparation on contextuality and measurement on contextuality. Under some operational equivalences, that can be verified experimentally. So basically, you need sort of some operational equivalences that you can go out, check in the lab, and then once you've checked those operational equivalences, then your inequality should hold in a non-contextual explanation. And if that inequality is violated, that means that modulo the fact that those operational equivalences hold, you have sort of correlations that are non-classical. And right, so our answer, yeah, so our answer is yes, that non-contextuality without determinism does impose non-trivial constraints on the operational statistics. And so an example of that is sort of in terms of this the Speckert scenario, which is like a simplified, it's kind of the simplest sort of scenario you can think of, because if you want to talk about measurement contextuality, you need two different contexts for one measurement, which means you need at least three measurements. So this is like the simplest thing you can cook up if you're trying to construct proofs of contextuality. And the thing is that you require these guys to be pairwise jointly measurable, which is that I should be able to measure these two together, I should be able to measure these two together, and these two together. So, right. So you see that it requires some sort of a non-trivial sort of compatibility structure. Like, if these were projective measurements, then you cannot have this, because things that pairwise commute are sort of compatible globally. Like, so if M1 commutes with M2, M2 with M3, M3 with M1, then they're all diagonal in the same basis, and you can, like, they're essentially the same. So the thing is that these measurements have to be essentially generalized measurements in the sense of positive operator-valued measures. So this is a scenario that you would not think of if a priori you were working with projective measurements. So that's why, for example, the 5-cycle in the KCBS in that previous scenario, which was the Kliashko scenario, is the thing you can do with projective measurements. But here you cannot do that because of this kind of structure. And so we have three binary outcome measurements, M1, M2, and M3. Outcome space is, again, 0, 1. Every pair is jointly measurable. Right. So for every pair, we consider the joint measurement, Mij, which is like for the pair I and Mi and Mj, such that the operational statistics of Mi, the measurement Mi, and measurement Mj are recovered as marginals of the operational statistics of Mij. So when you perform this 4-outcome measurement Mij, and you coarse grain over like one of the indices, you get one of these statistics for either of these measurements. So that's the meaning in which they're jointly measurable, in the sense that they admit a joint POVM. So we denote the outcome of Mij by this pair, Xi and Xj. And we let this guy, which is Mij or Mji, denote the coarse graining over Xj or over Xi of Mij. So essentially, these are just definitions of, so this is the distribution for measurement Mi when it is performed along with Mj, and you coarse grain over outcomes of X of Mj. And this is the distribution for Mj when it's measured with Mi, and you coarse grain over Xi, essentially outcomes of Mi. Right. So now we can express the assumption of pairwise joint measurability of M1, M2, and M3 as the following operational equivalences. So remember the definition of operational equivalence that I used earlier. So this is the same definition, which is that if you measure M1 with 2, so you measure M1 2, you coarse grain over 2, the thing you get for M1 is operationally equivalent to the thing you get when you do M1 with 3. And so they have to be the same measurement if it's really a joint measurement, if you're doing proper joint measurements. Then similarly, if M2, whether it's measured with 1 or with 3, has to be operationally equivalent, similarly for M3. And so this is like one set of measurements that we're considering, like for every pair. Then we also consider a second set of measurements, which is just indexed by a prime, like just to distinguish it from the first set, where you again have the same sort of conditions and you look for the same equivalences of these joint measurements. Right, so a Speckle scenario is, right, so we define a measurement M star as follows, which is you sample one of these three measurements, three pairs of measurements at random with probability 1/3, and then implement Mij and record the outcome Xi, Xj. So that's essentially your measurement procedure. You pick one of the three pairs at random and note down the outcome. And so we are interested in the probability of recording anticorrelated outcomes. So this is just notation, which is like for the average probability of anticorrelation, given that you perform this particular measurement procedure on some preparation. So which is 1/3 of like anticorrelation for the first guy, second guy, and third guy. And right, so we can define a similar quantity for the other set of joint measurements with the primed ones. And there you'd have this quantity, probability of obtaining anticorrelated outcomes. Okay, so this is, I'm just setting up things we need to state our inequality essentially. So we need those operational equivalences in terms of joint measurements. We need, so we are also interested in the this quantity, which is Xi given. So for a given measurement Mi, I'm interested in, of course, I'm interested in what predictions I get for different preparations for measurement on different for that measurement on different preparations. So you can measure this thing for any given p, and we'll be working with this particular quantity, which is you take the it's the two outcome measurement. M is a two outcome measurement. So you take the max of these two guys, whichever is larger. You take twice that and subtract one. So this is essentially, we call this the predictability, which is, it's a measure of how far away the distribution of our outcomes is from uniformly random. If this guy is half, these guys are uniformly distributed and both of them are half, then this guy is essentially zero, which is that there's no predictability, that it's perfectly random, right? And if one of them is one and the other one is zero, then this quantity is essentially one, which means perfect predictability. So this eta of M and P is essentially the predictability for measurement M given preparation P. And we are interested in this quantity. Right. So now suppose that we have sort of verified these operational equivalences. We have made sure that these guys are operationally equivalent, like these different implementations of M1, M2, M3. And we need some preparations that on which these measurements are going to be performed, essentially. So we need these preparation procedures. So there's a P star perpendicular, P1, P1 perpendicular, P2, P2 perpendicular, P3, P3 perpendicular. So we need sort of these 8 preparations. And we need an operational equivalence between the mixing of these preparations, essentially. So we need an operational equivalence between P star average, P1 star average, sorry, P1 average, P2 average, and P3 average, where PX average is the preparation procedure obtained by implementing PX with probability half and PX perpendicular with probability half. So it's like the equal mixture of these two preparations, these two preparations, these two, those two. And so we need to have these preparations which are operationally equivalent. Once you have these operational equivalences, then we are in a position to state our inequality, which is that if the ontological model for Speckle scenario is non-contextual, that is, you've assumed preparation non-contextuality and measurement non-contextuality, the following inequality on operational quantities will also hold, which is that the probability of anticorrelation for the first set of measurements denoted by M star on preparation P star plus the probability of anticorrelation on the second set of measurements with respect to this particular preparation, P star perpendicular, this particular bound holds on the sum of these two anticorrelation under the assumption of non-contextuality. Now, if you look at this bound, essentially, it quantifies the trade-off between how much anti-correlation you can achieve, which is the sum of these two guys, and the predictabilities of the three measurements. How predictable are these measurements, MIs, with respect to these preparations? And so the thing is, the more predictable you make them, if you make these two guys one, if they're completely predictable, then you'll get a 6/9 here, which is like 2 - 2/3, which is 4/3. So that 4/3 makes sense in a quotient-Specker setting, which is right. So the corresponding quotient-Specker inequality for this scenario is this, where like each guy is anti-correlated, like there's a 2/3 chance of anti-correlation, which you can see by just looking at this diagram, because if you're trying to assign 0-1 valuations here, then you can have a 0, you can have a 1, but then you have to have a 0 or a 1, so you know you can only get 2 out of 3 anti-correlations. So that would be like the quotient-Specker inequality, and you would expect a bound which is 4/3 if you were making the assumption of determinism. In our treatment, this inequality is justified if and only if you've verified that the predictabilities, these predictabilities, are 1 for all the measurements with respect to these preparations. And for example, if there's no predictability, if your etas are essentially 0, like so you get a half and a half for each measurement outcome, it's possible to achieve perfect anti-correlation in a non-contextual model. So this is that fact that I was trying to point out earlier. So if the second term is 0, then you achieve perfect anti-correlation. In general, for values between 0 and 1, the assumption of non-contextuality constrains the achievable anti-correlation non-trivially. So as long as this thing is sort of in between 0 and 1, you get some sort of non-trivial constraint. Sorry, hi.
I missed what the difference was between M and M prime.
The difference between M and M prime was essentially they were two different implementations of the same set of three measurements, pairwise implementations. So essentially you had M1, M2, M3. You want to measure, so this is like one set of measurement procedures you can implement. Mij prime is another set. And the thing is that the guys you're measuring are the same, so they should agree on those, on M1, M2, and M3. So the operational equivalences should hold. Right? So if you're saying that you're measuring M1, M2, and M3, then those marginalization conditions should hold. Essentially, that's the difference, essentially. And the assumption of that was the inequality. Sorry.
The perpendicular sign on the P, does it just indicate that it's a different preparation
It's a different preparation, but it's such. Not any different preparation. It's such that you have this particular equivalence hole. You want this equivalence to be valid. So this P1 average is a mixture of PX average is a mixture of PX and PX perpendicular with probability half each. So it's relative to this operational equivalence that I've included these perpendicular signs here, essentially. So it's the guy and its perpendicular guy mixed together uniformly. That should be equivalent for each of the indices. Okay, and the thing is that you can sort of violate that inequality in quantum theory. So you can construct sort of, I can give you a set of three measurements, and there's one set of pairwise implementations of those measurements, another set of pairwise implementations of those measurements. You compute the anti-correlation here, anti-correlation there, and I'll also give you preparations that satisfy those operational constraints. And then you can show that you can sort of exceed that non-contextual bound. So the measurements that we'll be looking at are essentially noisy spin measurements, which are now we are associating these measurements with like quantum objects. So MI is associated with this qubit POVM, which is EI naught and EI one, where EIB is EIB labels the index for like the particular outcome, so it's either 0 or 1. In particular, we assume that our measurements are of this type. So this is a simple example of a POVM, essentially two positive operators that sum to identity. And sigmas are your Pauli matrices, and it's all on a qubit, so these are qubit measurements. And so these three measurements essentially correspond to the choice of these directions in your block sphere. So Ni, N1, N2, and N3, these three directions. Okay. Furthermore, we consider two sets of pairwise joint measurements. One set is this, the other set is this. I've defined this notation earlier. So where Mij is associated with this four-element qubit POVM, which is saying that, so 0, 0 just means that Mi has outcome 0 and Mj has outcome 0. Similarly, for 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And this is the other implementation, which is E prime 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, so on. And so if you write down these four POVMs that you need to, so if you marginalize these POVMs, you'll see that they satisfy this constraint, which is that they should reproduce the marginals. And of course, they need to be positive. All these operators, they have to be positive. And there are two parameters. One is an alpha ij, and which is a scalar, and aij, which is like a three vector. So there are four real parameters that enter your description of the joint measurement. And the constraints on those parameters are essentially the ones that follow from the positivity of these operators. And similarly, this is your construction for the other guy, where all I've done is really taken, I've reversed signs here, essentially. I've taken aij to minus aij. And so you can verify these guys. So once these guys are verified, this you know from quantum theory, but if you just want to operationally verify the equivalences, you would actually measure the statistics and verify it. But if you're assuming quantum theory, then you would sort of not need to do that. But in our case, we do need to do that because we don't want to sort of rely on that assumption. And so those were the measurements. And now for the Px and Px perpendiculars. So Px is associated with the density operator rho x, which is essentially the projector along the direction nx. And similarly, the perpendicular guy is essentially the orthogonal state. And so x is again over star 1, 2, 3. And you know that if you mix these guys, then you'll get half identity for all choices of measurement directions. And the preparation procedures, P1 average, P2 average, P3 average, and P star average are all associated to the same mixed state. And consequently, we expect these operational equivalences of the ones that we need, that they are satisfied. And now this is just simple calculation. You just add up terms. Like this is what you're trying to compute. You're trying to compute the average anticorrelation. So you're taking 1/3 the probability given by the bond rule for anticorrelation for each pair. So every ij, you sum up the POVM elements that correspond to anticorrelation, compute the probabilities, sum them up, average them. And similarly for the second set of measurements, you compute these quantities and okay, this is just substitution. And eventually you get something like this. And the thing is, what sort of values can you attain for this quantity? So remember, these alpha ij's and aij's are constrained by the positivity of those operators. So they're not unconstrained, so to speak. And we choose our, so now I'll just specify an explicit choice of measurement directions. So we choose our measurements in an equatorial plane of the block sphere, let's say the zx plane. And the vector n star to be perpendicular to this plane. So your measurements are in the zx plane, and your this p n star is essentially the along the y axis. And so this is the set of three directions for the measurement. So these are separated by 120 degrees. So it's like a trine. So essentially something that looks like this. Uh, Okay. So we choose, so these AIJs and AlphaIJs are constrained by a set of inequalities, which kind of look ugly, which is why I didn't put them here. But if you look at those inequalities, then this set of choices for AIJ and AlphaIJ satisfies those inequalities, and we work with these choices. So we have these sort of dot products between all the vectors. So you have a minus half for each of these dot products. And since those dot products enter these values, you have these expressions for these guys. You compute everything. This is the expression for the quantum probability of anticorrelation, the sum of the two implementations. And then, so from if you look at the choices we've made for MI, PI, and PI perpendicular, then you can see that the predictabilities that you'll get for MI, PI, MI, PI perpendicular are all essentially the eta naught, the sort of the purity sort of parameter that enters the POVMs here. So those guys are equal to eta naught. And so from that you can infer that the non-contextual bound should look like this. And if you just compute the quantum violation, take the difference between the quantum quantity and the non-contextual bound, then you get an expression like this, kind of quadratic. And then you, so this is just the plot of that expression, which is like you see a violation. So this is the region of violation, essentially. And the maximum occurs at violation, the difference is essentially this, 0.1793. And it occurs for eta close to 0.4566 or so. You see a violation in all of that region. It's just different quant amounts. So now this treatment of Speckle scenario can be generalized, in fact. You can generalize it to n cycles. So you can consider n is equal to 5, 7, 9, so on. And the treatment is similar. I'm not going to go through the details. You again need some operational equivalences to be verified for the n sort of measurements that you have. You also need preparations. And the quantity you're interested in now is like earlier your n was 3, now it's some odd n. And for every pair, you're looking at anticorrelation, averaging the whole thing. And if you're assuming non-contextuality, then you should get something like this. So this is like the non-contextual bound. Quantum violation, again, the construction essentially just looks like this. That so this was the n is equal to 3 case where you had like measurements that were separated by 120 degrees each. So it was a 2 pi by 3 angle between each direction. Now you need a 4 pi by 5, for example, if n is equal to 5. So this is a general prescription for how you should choose your measurement directions. And so, for example, this angle is like 4 pi by 5 between n1 and n2, n2 and n3, n3 and n4, and n4 and n5. And you can construct a violation from this. So again, this is just the general expression for the n case. And if you tabulate these values, you'll see that like in the limit of infinite number of directions, you have this thing going to pi, and optimal eta naught sort of goes to 1, and your violation sort of vanishes. So essentially that was about Speckle's sort of parable, and I didn't really go into the parable per se, but it motivated from that paper. I encourage you to go read the one of the references, the first reference I'd mentioned in one of my first slides. So now I'll just mention like I have time, right? There's like 5 minutes.
Try to wrap it up in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is like another related question that actually arose while I was studying this Speckle kind of picture, which was that what are the allowed incompatibility relations between quantum observables? So by quantum observables, I mean sort of positive operator valued measures, and the question I'm asking is, let me just define things. So a POVM is essentially this, which is like mapping from an outcome set to positive operators on a Hilbert space, which sum up to identity. If you assume that each operator is a projection operator, then you get a projection valued measure. Joint measurability is, again, similar to how I used it in practice in that particular example, which is that a set of POVMs is jointly measurable when you can define a positive operator, a POVM M with positive operators given by this, such that the sum to identity, they marginalize appropriately to the marginals that you're looking for. So this is the notion of joint measurability we are working with. And I mean, the two terms are synonymous in this particular talk, joint measurability, compatibility. I mean joint measurability when I say compatibility. So we know that if you're just thinking of Hermitian operators and like projective measurements, then you know that commutativity is the same thing as compatibility for sharp projective measurements. That the joint measurability of sharp measurements is decided pairwise. So commutativity is like a binary property of like two things, two operators. And if you are given a set of n operators, if they pairwise commute, then you know that they're compatible. So compatibility a priori is not a binary property. You can talk about compatibility of three things, four things, five things, and they need not reduce to the pairwise thing. In the case of sharp measurements, it does reduce to the pairwise property. So you can decide compatibility of sharp measurements just given the commutativity relations. And the thing is that commutativity implies compatibility in general. So if you have pairwise, So this implies compatibility in general, but the converse does not hold. So for example, if you're looking at unsharp measurements, which are POVMs, so not projective valued measures, then compatibility does not imply commutativity. And this is just a definition for what I call a joint measurability hypergraph, which is essentially this, that if I'm given a set of n measurements, so here I'm given a set of three measurements, and I postulate and I ask, is it possible to come up with a set of three measurements such that they're pairwise jointly measurable? And And the other thing is that when they're not connected, since there's no circle that covers all three together, I require triplewise incompatibility in this hypergraph picture for measurements. So you know that this cannot be realized with projection valued measures. Similarly, this guy cannot be realized with projection valued measures. And the question was that if you come up with some arbitrary thing like this, can you always have those relationships between can you ascribe quantum observables to these vertices? And essentially, this is like one of the results in one of those papers that I mentioned initially, that every set of POVMs on H has a joint measurability hypergraph. So figuring out that hypergraph is essentially the problem of deciding the compatibility structure of a set of observables. What we solve is like the converse problem, which is that if you're given a set of incompatibility relations, it's a prescription for constructing observables that satisfy those incompatibility relations. So this is just the statement, which is that every joint measurability hypergraph admits a quantum realization with POVMs. I'll not go through the proof. I'll just refer you to the paper if you're interested. Let me just conclude with like what we have done so far, which is that non-contextuality without determinism allows us to give theory-independent criteria, which are like non-contextuality inequalities in this case, for deciding whether your operational statistics admits a classical explanation in the sense of non-contextual models. They provide a more rigorous benchmark for non-classicality than quotient-Speckler inequalities, for the reasons that I mentioned, that if your measurements are not too predictable, then you have no reason to believe that a violation of quotient-Speckler inequalities is very surprising. Quantum theory admits all conceivable incompatibility relations between observables. So this is like the last thing that I mentioned. This is, I think, one of the more sort of philosophical conclusions, I think, from the paper, which is from our results, which is that unquestioning adherence to the church of the larger Hilbert space can forbid the faithful from asking new questions. And this is in the sense that the questions that we ask do not arise for projective measurements. You would not study those problems if you were only thinking of projective measurements. And so there are some open questions, obviously. So could one argue for operational equivalences from a physical principle independent of quantum theory? in a manner that's similar to the no signaling condition from relativity for Bell scenarios. So when you're talking about Bell scenarios and Bell experiments, then you need this no signaling condition. And typically the way you enforce that without using the formalism of quantum theory is to say that things are space-like separated, hence no signaling should hold. If the signaling happens, then in the presence of space-like separation, that's a contradiction with relativity. So relativity gives you sort of a reason to believe in no signaling without having to assume quantum theory. So you use that kind of thing to essentially say that measurements in this wing are independent, outcomes in this wing are independent of measurements of a space-like separated wing. And so we need to verify all our operational equivalences in the experiment. So we need to actually go check everything by hand. So there's no sort of compelling reason to believe a priori that those operational equivalences should hold. So if you can give a physical sort of reason for why those operational equivalences should hold, then that sort of obviates the need to, you know, verify every equivalence by hand. And the thing is that you want it to be independent of quantum theory because you're trying not to assume quantum theory. And so could one devise new non-contextuality inequalities for scenarios that arise of joint measurability hypergraphs? So this is kind of still in work in progress. I have a few examples, but they're not really operational. So then the last one of the open questions is, could one come up with, you know, some information theoretic tasks in which these results could be exploited in a way that's not been done before? So yeah, I think that's about it. Thanks.
Questions for Ravi? Could you say a bit more about why you need this M and M prime?
Yeah.
Naively, you might expect that if just one fine grain
So that was because we were trying to use preparation non-contextuality in our proof. And so that's why you have the P and P perpendicular, where you have a half and a half for those guys. And if you remember, if you look at the expressions, then M is measured with respect to P star, and M prime is measured with respect to P star perpendicular. So the thing is that when you think of it in terms of a non-contextual model, then you can combine things together and use preparation non-contextuality. So because this, the mixture of P star and P star perpendicular is indistinguishable from P1 perpendicular. So we use that property to sort of derive our inequality. We weren't able to do it just for like one of these guys. Because, basically you need to figure out a clever way to use preparation non-contextuality to get like a bound. And the bound that we could get was for like this particular combination. It'll be nice to have it like for a simple quantity which doesn't involve like two different sets of measurements. And in fact, we do have some sort of examples which I did not talk about in this talk, but which are sort of much simpler and which are essentially in some sense taking like stuff that's been done so far in Cushion-Specker sort of inequalities and trying to make them operational, trying to make them sort of well motivated in the sense of you know, rigorous benchmarks for non-classical correlations. So,
I just make a comment.
Yeah,
I think your intuition is right, although we don't have an example yet. So, if you just have P star and you're measuring M star on it, then you know that some of your ontic states can't be highly predictable. So, if you've gone and measured that all these measurements are highly predictable, you'll get a contradiction. So, there should be some inequality. But it'll probably be a worse inequality than this one because here P star perp also generates a lot of anticorrelation, so it can't be highly predictable either. And so now you sort of all the ontic states have that property that they're not highly predictable. So it's going to be a better inequality than one that just relied on P star. Because then it basically, any inequality that just relied on P star would say nothing about the part of the ontic state space in the support of everything else, you know, the stuff that I have to mix with M star to get the completely mixed state.
Is every theory with incompatible observable contextual?
Not necessarily. The thing is that you need to show that that incompatibility actually leads to correlations that you cannot explain in sort of a non-contextual manner.
So
So that's not sufficient. It's necessary, obviously. You need incompatibility to show non-trivial correlations, but it's not sufficient. Because in Bell inequalities, for example, if you have commuting observables at one wing, then you don't get any violations, right? Because you've done away with all the incompatibility in the problem, so.
So is there a single criteria that a certain amount of incompatibility will ensure contextuality?
So that's an interesting open question, actually. How do you sort of relate, like, quantify firstly the amount of incompatibility and then maybe try to understand how that relates to what sorts of violations you can get for non-contextual inequalities. I mean, I'm not aware of like a work which does this, but I don't know, if you're aware, let me know. Do you know any?
There's something that does that for Bell inequalities.
Right.
And they are contextualizing.
Which what does it?
That links the degree of non-joint measurability.
Yeah, the sharpness. You mean this result on showing the duality between CHSH and the joint measurability problem, right? Yeah. So that's an example of, yeah. Okay, so there's this paper by Michael Wolff and I think David Perez Garcia on, so it's a 2009 PRL on I think it's called Measurements Incompatible in Quantum Theory are Incompatible in General or something like that. And there they prove a theorem which tries to show a tight connection between these two problems, which is like deciding Bell inequality violations and deciding joint measurability of observables. So that's like a quantitative statement of what you were asking me like right now in the context of Bell scenarios.
Just a simple question. Is your notion of joint measurability the same as if I had these three measurements, then I can measure them in any sequence that I want?
That would be the notion that you'd get from commutativity, right? That's what you'd mean when you say things are commute, right? I mean,
okay, so
if things commute, then that's sufficient for joint measurability, but it's not necessary. That's the connection, essentially. Yeah.
So is there any simple criteria for determining whether the two measurements are compatible?
No, there's a lot of, there are criteria, for example, for qubit. For qubit observables, it's you know the set of necessary and sufficient conditions to decide it. Like for two-element POVMs, like not very general ones. And in general, it's kind of an open problem. There's a lot of papers. If you want to look at papers, then you should probably look at some work by Tycho Hainosari. He has a lot of papers in trying to decide when two observables are jointly measurable in higher dimensions even. But there's a set of like sufficient conditions, but they're not necessary conditions, not sufficient. There's no complete characterization. There's no nice sort of way to decide it.
Do you know if there are any statistics that violate your inequality but admit a preparation non-contextual model?
By? No, because preparation non-contextuality would be, it's part of the, we do need preparation non-contextuality for our inequality, so.
Right, but I'm asking if we need measurement non-contextuality.
We do, because that's the sense in which we need like these operational equivalences between the two different implementations, right? Like to talk about anti-correlations in that scenario, and to be able to, so essentially, if you think about how measurement non-contextuality really arises in this picture, it's in terms of having consistent marginal statistics for like the M1, M2, and M3 that you're measuring, and that's essentially analogous to the no signaling condition that you have in Bell scenarios. So it's like something that you need to have even before, like you know, if you're talking experiments of these kinds where you're looking at measurement outcomes, and so. Do you see that connection? Like the fact that you need this, your marginals to be consistent, like to agree regardless of what context it's measured in, it's sort of, it's the no signaling condition in the Bell sort of setup.
So we did use that, but it's clear that we could not derive it from the assumption of preparation on the spectrum of it. So a slightly simpler version of your question.
From that alone.
Yeah,
right.
So it turns out to be true that from preparation non-contextuality in quantum theory, you can actually derive measurement non-contextuality for projective measurements.
Right. So that's in quantum theory, right?
In quantum theory, right?
That's something that was in your paper, right, Matt? Okay.
No, not quite.
So I thought I saw it in yours. Because
outcome determinism
yeah.
can be derived from preparation.
Yes.
But also measurement not
yes, yes. So that was your result, right? Yeah.
It wasn't our paper, it turns out we'll knew about it already.
Oh, okay. But you didn't write.
You knew that result how
okay, I didn't know but there is an open question here, which is even given quantum theory, can you derive measurement not contextuality for unsharp measurements from preparation not contextuality? That would be nice. If that were true, then preparation not contextuality would be like, you know, the mother of non contextuality assumptions because you could derive all others from it. But you're asking an even harder question, which is might it be that with you know, just having done some experiments, it's enough to assume preparation non contextuality to get some non trivial inequalities. And then
I mean, there are examples of that, right? I mean, stuff that you did on
this
inequality right. that relies only on preparation non-contextuality. So, but I'm not sure you can do that in this particular scenario because here you are like using these correlations between measurements. You need them to be consistent. So that's it's like a necessary requirement to even state the problem, no?
Well, imagine that you have this experiment. You tested the operational equivalence of your measurements, but rather making an inference from those operational equivalents of measurements to the response functions using the assumption of measurement non-contextuality, you use just the assumption of preparation non-contextuality. You might still get some non-trivial constraints on those response functions. So it could be that this very inequality that we wrote down there could actually be derived entirely from preparation non-contextuality if you've gone and verified those operational equivalences.
But you'll have to add some operational equivalences to...
Sorry?
Are you saying that you include some additional operational equivalences to use?
No. So I mean, the idea is a bit that, you know, we know if quantum theory is true that we can get measurement non-contextuality, projective measurements from preparation non-contextuality. Now, suppose that, you know, we go to the lab and we find everything's perfectly deterministic, and then it would ultimately, we could sort of justify it experimentally as well. And so it's just the same question now, but for a broader notion of measurement non-contextuality.
Right. Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Ravi again.
Thank you.